Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The son of blue-collar immigrant parents, a decorated World War II bombardier, and civil rights activist, Howard Zinn is one of the country's most celebrated historians and one of the very few with a true cult following. From high schoolers to Hollywood stars, over a million readers have fallen hard for his best-selling A People's History of the United States, for its unique retelling of American history from the bottom up, history by the masses. Tonight on Point, a conversation and an update with the people's historian, Howard Zinn. But first, today in Houston, Texas, a federal judge tentatively accepted a plea agreement for a prison term for the wife of former Enron finance chief Andrew Fastow. The move could lead to a plea from Fastow himself and perhaps his cooperation with prosecutors investigating Enron's collapse. John Emschweiler is a senior writer for The Wall Street Journal. I asked him about the latest developments in the Enron case.
They're trying to put together an elaborate set of sort of deals in Houston involving the two Fastows, Andy Fastow, the former chief financial officer, and his wife, Lee. The idea is that Lee will plead guilty to one criminal count, and if that goes through, then Andy will have his own plea agreement, which will involve a 10-year prison sentence in cooperation with the government. The problem has been is that the judge in Lee Fastow's case has been unwilling to sign off on the deal's terms of a 5-month prison sentence and 5 months of home detention on the possibility he thinks that might be a little too low. So he wants to go through a pre-sentence report, which could take a couple of months.
Now, let's get the bigger picture with the Fastows for a moment then. Andy Fastow was the chief financial officer. His wife, Lee, was assistant treasurer at Enron Corporation. They're married. They have two children, right?
Two young sons, and that's been one of the concerns expressed by the Fastow camp throughout this, where there's been two, both of them under indictment, is that if they both went to prison, the children could have no parents for years.
Meanwhile, if Andrew Fastow pleads guilty, he would be the highest-ranking executive to do so in this criminal investigation of Enron. The two top executives, Kenneth Lay and Jeffrey Skilling, are not yet facing charges. Is that right?
Right. He would be the highest level to plead so far, and also potentially the most valuable to government investigators in their ongoing probe, because he was at the very top levels of Enron for years, in the middle of their most controversial suspect transactions, had daily or at least very regular contacts with Lay, Skilling, and other top officials. So we don't know what secrets Andy Fastow might be able to turn over to the government, but they could be extremely valuable to the prosecutors.
So if this is a plea bargain, and it doesn't sound all that light at 10 years and $20 million, but if that's a plea bargain, the deal would be, at least if it followed typical form, that he would be giving information in return that might give them the basis for bringing charges against Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling.
Exactly. You know, when you're doing these deals, the defendant starts giving up preliminarily, well, here's what I could tell you.
Mm-hmm.
And based on that, it's from what we've been able to gather, is they've already put together a criminal complaint against former chief accounting officer Richard Causey. That filing of that criminal complaint has been held up pending a resolution. Will Andy Fastow actually go through with his plea agreement, which, of course, is basically resting on whether his wife, Lee Fastow, will go through with hers first. So then a chain of events have to happen.
Right. But if the Fastows then accept these agreements, 5 months in prison for Lee Fastow, the wife and mother, 10 years for Andy Fastow, the dominoes could start falling pretty quickly here toward further charges.
Yes, there could well be charges very quickly against some, and perhaps charges down the road, or maybe even quickly against Lay and Skilling. It's still not clear whether they will ever file charges against Lay and Skilling. You know, they obviously don't feel they yet have enough evidence of criminal wrongdoing to file cases, or they would have.
Andrew Fastow's 42 years old. He's charged with fraud, money laundering, insider trading, and more. It's been something of a mystery why the charges couldn't go on up, but the well-known whistleblower at Enron, Sharon Watkins, said just today, she said, "Sometimes I liken Jeff Skilling to a mafia boss who used particular words. He never said, 'Go whack Joey.' He said, 'Go take care of Joey.'" What does she mean by that? That there was code used by the top execs? They never exactly ordered illegality?
Well, I don't know. You'd have to ask Sharon what exactly she meant by that. I kind of shy away from using terms like mafia for guys in business.
I guess she's just trying to convey a sense of why it might be difficult to bring these charges against the top guys.
One of the things you have to show in a criminal case, if critical, is criminal intent. You have to show that the person, you know, knew that they were breaking the law and intended to defraud. One of the problems I think they have in the Enron case they've had throughout is that, one, a lot of the stuff that was done, a lot of the most controversial, smelly-looking stuff, was approved by Enron's outside auditors and many of Enron's attorneys. So it makes it easier for a layer to say, well, look, we were relying on experts. The other problem is that I don't think that Lay and Skilling did not leave a lot of paper trail. So that's where a guy like Fastow could become very valuable, because he might be able to say, well, look, I had this conversation with X, and we talked about this, and this person knew. Now, that by itself might not be enough, but it could be corroboration for some other things, you know, in documentary evidence, so that would be enough to then say, yes, now we can bring a case against this person with Andy's help. And Andy's help may bring pressure on other lower-level officials below the top that they might then start cooperating, like maybe a Causey or somebody else, which could also provide evidence against a layer of Skilling.
Richard Causey, Enron's former chief accountant.
Yes, basically his lawyers have said he's done nothing wrong in the past, but if he gets charged, then he's going to have to deal, obviously, with that fact if they do file a criminal complaint against him.
Meanwhile, we have the spectacle of this very 90s two-income couple trying to sort out who goes to prison first.
Yes, and it's kind of a sort of strange perversion of the, you know, like whose career comes first.
Lee Fastow's lawyer Mike Guerin said today, "You'd have to be a mother to fully understand she has two children at home and 5 months works. Anything more than that doesn't." What about for Andrew Fastow? 10 years, $20 million. That's not a slap on the wrist. Could it be worse if they laid the full time, all the charges on him without a plea bargain?
Oh, yes. He's scheduled still to go to trial in April. And if he got convicted, he's got close to 100 counts filed against him by the federal government. If he got convicted on all or a substantial number, he could easily face 20, 25 years in prison under federal sentencing guidelines. So, yes, there could be a much bigger downside if he lost at all.
So we may be seeing right here the first unraveling of the Enron corner offices, with much more potentially to come.
Yeah, the government's been moving along now for 2 years. They've gotten a couple dozen indictments or guilty pleas. But now with Fastow, they're reaching a new level in the corporate suite.
John, thanks very much for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
John Emshwiler is a senior writer for The Wall Street Journal and is co-author of the book 24 Days, How Two Wall Street Journal Reporters Uncovered the Lies That Destroyed Faith in Corporate America. He spoke with us from Los Angeles. Howard Zinn believes that ordinary people can shape history through social movements, that the common man should have primacy over the great man view of history. In 1980, Zinn laid down his version of American history in the best-selling A People's History of the United States. As of early last year, more than 1 million copies have been sold. Today, Howard Zinn's People's History is enshrined in high school and college classrooms across the country. It's a classic, and also a remarkably radical view of the world. Tonight on Point, the People's Historian, Howard Zinn, and his best-selling book, A People's History of the United States. Do you remember when you first read this historian's revolutionary take on American history? Do you remember the thrill of reading radical history for the first time? And does it still thrill you today? We're at 1-800-423-8255 tonight. You can join us at 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is historian, playwright, and social activist Howard Zinn. His best-selling, A People's History of the United States, has sold over 1 million copies. It's out now in a new paperback edition. Good evening and welcome back to On Point, Howard Zinn.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
It's great to have you. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to Mr. Zinn.
Howard Zinn, take us back, if you would, over this last year. There's been a lot of celebration of the millionth copy of your book going out the door. I mean, who would have thunk it in 1980? It wasn't exactly a mainstream history textbook here. And yet, in many dimensions, it's moved right into the mainstream of American education. What's it been like for you personally, looking back on the lifetime, the evolution of the place in our culture of the book that you put out so many years ago?
Well, you know, I was surprised, and the publishers were surprised by how the book took off, because it didn't take off immediately, and the publishers didn't have great expectations. But, you know, they published 5,000 copies in the first printing, and then every year it sold more than the year before, until now it sells over 100,000 copies a year. But what it has said to me, and what I think it has said to my editors at HarperCollins, is that there has been a great hunger out in the country for a different view of the United States and of our history, a view that's different than the conventional view that's given in the textbooks. And I think that the movements of the 60s and 70s did a lot to prepare a good part of the population to look critically at the United States, to look at our racial policies, to look at a question of economic equality, to look at American foreign policy. Certainly the Vietnam War caused so many people to begin to look very critically at the role of the United States in the world. And so I think that people, large numbers of people in this country, have been prepared and are still prepared to see a critical view of the United States, which sees American history from the point of view of working people, black people, women, you know, people who are not usually paid attention to in the traditional histories.
Not the traditional vantage. A lot of our listeners may well have read your book, given how widely it's assigned in classrooms and how it continues to leap off of bookstore shelves. Many have not, though. I know it's second nature to you, but I think even today it'll be arresting for people who read this for the first time. Share a sense with our listeners, Howard Zinn, of how your vantage on history, how your take on history differed from so much of what had come before in traditional history, traditional American history.
You know, well, of course, the very first example that people come across when they see my book, and it's the most startling to generations of Americans who learn, you know, as we all did in elementary school, Columbus discovered America, great man, great feat. And then they read my book and they find, well, Columbus, yes, he did come. He was an adventurer. He was brave. But he used the Indians to find gold. He slaughtered Indians. He mutilated them. He kidnapped them. He was, in a sense, the first European imperialist in the Western world. He was the beginning of that long wave of European invasion of the Western Hemisphere.
This was not your father's Oldsmobile, your father's history lesson told in 1940, 1950, even 1960.
It was, certainly wasn't my history lesson when I was going to school. And what people find when they read my history is they find things, you know, reversed. And in this sense, that the usual histories talk about the great economic miracle of the United States, how we became a great industrial power. And,
but, of course, the country did become a great industrial power.
The country did become a great industrial power. But the question that was left out was, at what cost to human life and to human beings? We did become a great industrial power. But in the course of it, how many working people died? How many working people got sick? How many of them worked 12 and 14 hours a day? And how did their kids survive or not survive in the terrible heat and the cold of the cities in the summer and in the winter? What about these people? What about the girls who went to work in the textile mills of New England at the age of 12 and died at the age of 25? What about the miners who had no safety regulations to help them, and so you had explosion after explosion? In other words, there was a cost paid for this industrial expansion. Great profits were made. Yes, the gross national product grew and grew, but the working people of the country, they had to fight on their own. The country wasn't going to, the nation wasn't going to do it. The government wasn't going to do it. The Constitution didn't protect them. The working people had to go out on strike, and they had to sacrifice. They had to face the police. They had to face the army in order to win the eight-hour day.
Howard Zinn, stand by. We want to hear a lot more about how you see this having sunk in, not having sunk in, all those readers, how much has really stuck. We're talking tonight with people's historian Howard Zinn about his classic work, A People's History of the United States. Were you weaned on Howard Zinn's People's History? Was it your freshman in high school assignment, freshman in college? Was it a revelation for you? Is it still a revelation today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with people's historian Howard Zinn about his classic work, A People's History of the United States, published in 1980. It's now, as of early last year, sold over a million copies, and that's been celebrated all through this last year. You can join our conversation with Howard Zinn tonight. Is this an only in America story, a radical historian's work being handed by the truckload to school kids? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk. Jack Beattie, you've been listening up in New Hampshire. You've, of course, read Howard's work and followed him for years. Give us a sense, in your view, of how Howard Zinn's history fits into the sort of flow and understanding of American history.
Well, you know, you have to look at what came before, the sort of consensus view of American history, most notably in the work of Richard Hofstadter, whom I admire, but was really a basically conservative man who took a sort of scoffing notion at reformers and reform and thought it all a kind of swindle, and who thought that there wasn't much conflict in American history, that things were pretty good for most people most of the time. And that was sort of the view up until the 1960s, when people like Howard and others looked around and they didn't see all this content. They didn't see this this consensus. They saw all kinds of people left out. And they effectively looked back in history and as one person said, began to write the history of the inarticulate, not of the movers and the shakers, but of the moved and the shaken. And to put a new driver at the center of history, the ordinary man and woman, and to honor their experience, and to say that, well, yes, it's Theodore Roosevelt's a very interesting man and all the rest of that, but look at the lives of people who were in the factories. Look at the solidarities they formed. Look at the sacrifices they made for their families. It's this that made history. There's a poem of Brecht's that begins, "Who built the seven towers of Thebes? The books are filled with the names of kings. Was it kings who hauled the craggy blocks of stone?" It wasn't kings. It was the sort of ordinary men and women who get their due, both as historical actors and as victims, in many cases, in Howard's history.
Howard Zinn, I'm struck looking back at your work at how really radical it is. And I wonder if you find that most of your readers, are they titillated by this, what is to many a new perspective, or are they really embracing the politics beneath? I mean, you make a very deep, thoroughgoing critique of capitalist economics, of nationalism as understood and practiced in the United States. You paint a vision of a people's society, that's fairly fully socialist, communist, call it what you will. You're careful to say not in the model of the Soviet Union and others, but still a place where people, you know, work a few hours for the community, where housing is free, where food is free, where transportation is free according to people's needs. And you talk about a kind of, you know, revolution at the grassroots. What portion of your readers do you think really get focused on that? Is it the thrill of seeing Columbus described as a marauder that catches people, or do they really get down to the politics that you're proposing, that you're working from?
Well, I don't know. That is, you know, I'd have to interrogate all these people who read my book. But it's more than titillation. I mean, I would hate to say, of course, that, oh, it's titillation, because that's superficial, right? But
I'm teasing you, but you know what I mean.
Sure.
There's a deep rudder underneath this, and I wonder what percentage of this million-plus readers really get to that rudder, really embrace the rudder.
I would guess that a lot of them do. And the reason I say this is that although you call this a radical history,
You call it a radical history as well, by the way.
I do, too, of course. I'm glad we both call it a radical history. But, you know, it is not that radical if you consider that most Americans, if you sort of take the words away, if you have people stop talking about socialism and capitalism and stop using these abstractions, if you ask people, do you think everybody should have health care? Everybody should have health care without having to pay for it. Do you think everybody should have housing? Do you think everybody should have enough food?
For free.
For free, yes. Do you think, and do you think this country is rich enough to afford it? And do you think that maybe this country should stop sending troops all around the world pretending to save democracy and liberty, but actually sort of extending the power of the American empire?
But you're not suggesting that it's a marginal step from the status quo today to the vision that you outline. You're not suggesting that's a small step or moderate step.
No.
You're suggesting a kind of revolutionary step.
It's a big step. But I believe that that vision is something that really speaks to a huge number of American people. It's just that our national political leaders don't speak to this vision. Our national political leaders have a very narrow vision, and so they peck away at the edges, you know, of our current policy, but they don't get very basic. You won't find them saying, we should not be a war-making nation anymore. You don't find them saying, we should not be a militaristic nation that spreads troops and bases around the world and that uses its wealth to help people here, to help people abroad. You won't find a leader saying that, but I believe those are the ideas that appeal to ordinary people. And when I go around the country and I speak all over the country to all sorts of groups, including a lot of high schools, you know, I don't speak just to people who already agree with me, and I find that when I lay down what appear to be radical ideas about what the country should be like, about a country that's at peace and a country where things are shared, that we use the wealth of the country for human needs, people respond to that. So it's not very radical.
Of course, the country
radical.
Also fought a Cold War for decades,
yes.
Against the putative vision of that.
No, we didn't. No, they didn't fight a war against that vision. They fought a war against the reality of the Soviet Union.
Well,
which did not embody that vision.
Of course, it was the reality, but it was also the vision. There were many Americans who didn't accept this vision, who didn't like the idea of a shared, you know, common weal where everyone ate from the same big bowl. That was clearly, if you look at the writings of the time, part of what was being fought against. I wonder, though, you've added some new chapters to the book as it's gone along, on the Clinton presidency, on 9/11, and terrorism. But already in 1980, you must have ended it then with a chapter entitled The Coming Revolt of the Guards. Mm. And you described a kind of social structure with super rich on top, millions of poor and oppressed in your language at the bottom, and in between the kind of doctors and lawyers and teachers and middle class. Who you described as guards, almost like prison guards, who were sort of making this whole system work sort of on behalf of the very rich. And you saw in 1980, or when you wrote it a year or two before, those people, the middle class, kind of turning on those above and ready to revolt, ready to throw their lot instead with impoverished America, with the low tier of America. And then came Reagan and George H.W. Bush and Clinton and George W. Bush. Mm. Were you too rosy in your expectation of what was coming, Howard Zinn, or were you just ahead of the curve?
Well, of course, I would never claim I was too rosy. But I wasn't suggesting that this vision I had of a different America would come in the next 4 years or 8 years. But I was suggesting...
It's been 23 years now.
It's been 23 years. I didn't even suggest it would come in 23 years. And I wouldn't even today dare to predict when it would come. But I do believe that it will come. That when I say it will come, I believe that more and more Americans, especially middle-class Americans, are going to realize that their security, their future, does not lie with giving the rich the power that the rich have always had in this country. I believe that the people in the middle, as well as the people in, you know, the working classes, I believe that they will more and more see that they have a common interest, for instance, in not going to war, that they have a common interest in having universal health care, they have a common interest in creating a society which is not going to be so badly divided in its economic, you know, division of spoils that you have 2 million people in prison in the United States. I mean, that's a sign that something is sick in the society. And so, yeah, I do believe that more and more people in the middle class are going to realize that the people who are running the country are not doing them any good.
Howard Zinn, Jack, let me turn to our callers. Linda's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Linda. You're on the air.
Thank you. I want to say thank you, first of all, for your program. And Thank you, Howard Zinn, from the bottom of my heart, for your lifetime's work and this particular book. I first heard you speak, I think, last year at the Peace March against the war on Iraq. And I decided there and then to become a citizen after living in America for many, many years. And that's going to happen on Wednesday.
It's coming right up. And Howard Zinn was the one who pushed you to do it, Linda.
Because it gave me faith that there are good people, millions of good people that really care in America, and that we need to get the word out. And people like Howard Zinn get the information out. Our media doesn't do it. And I don't believe that there can be a democracy when we have so little information in America about the true nitty-gritty of what's going on behind the scenes. I grew up in Scotland, and it was not great there either, growing up in the 50s. I wasn't taught about the history of Scotland. I wasn't taught that the tanks came into George Square after the First World War and turned against the soldiers returning because the English government was afraid that Scotland was going to rebel like Russia. I wasn't taught that at school. But the media in Europe is definitely informing people. It takes on an educational stand way, way more. It's the situation in America is extreme. And that's why we desperately need people like Howard Zinn.
It sounds like it will have one more Zinn citizen next year. Linda, thanks very much for your call. Okay. Jack Beattie, I want to turn to you for a moment because I know that while you and Howard probably share a lot of perspective in common, I've also heard you express some misgivings about this view of the world and this interpretation of history. Where's your common ground with Howard Zinn, Jack, and where do you part ways?
Well, I mean, I've been reading him for years, and I greatly admire him, and certainly my dad was a janitor, and he helped start a union so that other janitors, people today, can live a better life. So I come out of the same world that Howard comes out of, and I honor that, but on the other side, it just seems to me that when you look at the American people and you look at the American political culture, kind of an unwieldy generalization, what's striking about it is that it is a conservative political culture, and that means sort of the stuff that's both inside people and that's outside people influencing them. I mean, our foundation belief, according to Bernard Bailyn, the basis of our whole political culture is that power is an evil. Just the fact of power is evil. And Americans, I mean, that the founders set up a government where power was just all, you know, divided so that there couldn't be a concentration of this evil thing. Well, that just intrinsically focuses people on government as something that is intrinsically an evil. Its power is threatening. And the other thing in American political culture is property. You know, the socialist historian Werner Sombart partly ruefully said socialism in America founded on shoals of roast beef. He didn't mean that everybody got the roast beef, but he meant that everybody hoped for it, that everybody worked for it, and that while people liked the idea of equality, that for many people it meant equality in competition. I want my property. I want my bit of roast beef. And what's unique about America is that you can do that. And, you know, you even see that in reactions people have to the death tax, the inheritance tax. Mm-hmm. 122 people in Maine a year die with estates that are taxable. But, you know, polls show that many people think, I'm going to be one of them. I'm not poor. I'm just pre-rich. This is a basic fact about America. Mm-hmm. This intrinsically conservative political culture founded on a fear about power and on property, and add to that the ethnic and religious heterogeneity of America, where it's very hard to get people together on a class basis, and you've got a break on the kind of vision and world that Howard and in many and in some moods me would like to see created.
Howard Zinn, how about that? You've written a people's history, but is it then really at bottom the American people's history? Jack Beatty's saying, yeah, there's some strains in this American people that may not fit into this framework.
Well, you know, when you're talking, as Jack does, about the political culture, now, I think he put his finger on it when he talked about the culture inside and the culture from outside, because I think we ought to recognize that this culture outside, that is all of the forces that are impinging on the American mind,
mm-hmm.
all of the information that people get from television, from the major newspapers, and yes, and even in the educational system, that culture, I think, leads people into nationalism. I think it leads them, let's say, to believe in the death penalty. I think
We have to grant that. But Jack's saying something else. He's saying it's not just outside in; it's inside.
Yes.
This suspicion of power, this respect for property, some kind of roadblocks to the Zinn view.
Well, the suspicion of power, of course, is a good thing. My book throughout creates a suspicion of power. It's very important that people be suspicious of the people who hold power in the government, who have the power to send their kids to war, mm-hmm. and have the power to create a tax structure that funnels wealth into the upper classes. It's very important for people to have the suspicion of power. I think that's a very healthy thing.
And a deep respect for property, you'd like to take capitalism down. It's hard to do that when people say, hey, that's my roast beef.
No, well, everybody wants roast beef. But I think it's very important to distinguish between people having sort of the basics that people want and that people need and that they deserve. They have a right to have a right to a decent home and have a right to have decent food.
But Americans want more than that. As Jack says, they see themselves as pre-rich.
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that Americans feel the need to be multimillionaires. I don't think Americans feel the need to be in that upper 1%. I think most Americans would be really happy if they had economic security in the sense of being able to send their kids to college and being able to pay their mortgage and having all the kinds of fundamental needs met.
That would feel good, too. Somehow, very often, these seem to live side by side. They like those fundamental needs met. On the other hand, that dream, that golden dream, is also there.
Well, that golden dream has been presented by the culture, the Horatio Alger myth. But I think most people understand that they are not going to become members of that upper 1% of the population. And so I don't see that as a problem. I see people more and more recognizing, that the wealth of this country is sufficient to really take care of everybody's needs. Everybody won't be equal. Some people have more than others. But there'll be fundamental needs that will be met for everybody.
We're going to come back, Howard Zinn, and talk to a lot of callers who want to talk to you and look at the current situation in war, in an election year, how the Howard Zinn view fits in. We're talking tonight with the people's historian, Howard Zinn, about his classic work, A People's History of the United States. You can join the conversation. Were you weaned on Howard Zinn's People's History? Do you see Howard Zinn's revolution on the horizon, the uprising of almost everyone? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with people's historian Howard Zinn about his classic work, A People's History of the United States. You can join our conversation tonight. Do you remember the thrill of reading radical history for the first time? Does it still thrill you today? And how will the people's history of this century read? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Howard Zinn, a lot of the people would like to join you. Let's go to them. Tom's calling from South Beloit, Illinois. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Good evening. First of all, I don't consider it radical history. Secondly, you wanted to know when I discovered it. I discovered it when I was in my 40s, and I went back to college to get a history degree, and I used it as a reference. But what my question was for Howard Zinn was, how much has he been censored, and, how much do the right-wing think tanks and even the right-wingers in general try to shut him down and censor him?
Tom, we'll put it to him, but I got to say, with a million copies of the book on the street, it doesn't sound like too heavy a boot, but let's see. Howard Zinn, what do you say?
Well, the only thing I suppose that you might say that they're able to do, keep me off the major the major networks, I will be invited to, On Point. I'll be invited to The Connection. I'll be invited to the Bill Moyers Show.
Yeah.
And very, very occasionally to the Lara NewsHour. But, the major television.
You're not on Fox News every
night.
No,
not on Fox News. And so, Tom is right. They certainly don't – people up there with the power don't welcome my book and would love to shut me out. But the fact is – And I think this is a tribute to the American popular culture, that we are able to create networks of communication in which, my book can be welcomed by a million people. Noam Chomsky's work, Barbara Ehrenreich's work, Michael Moore's work, despite all the attempts of the right wing to keep us quiet. So that's, I think, a positive development.
A kind of a culture of protest that may drive them crazy, but you're part of it.
Yes.
Tom, thanks for your call. Dara's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Dara. You're on the air.
Thank you. Yes, I've connected with Professor Zinn's book twice in my life in places that he might find unexpected.
Tell us about it, Dara.
The first was 2 years out of college. I was teaching junior high school American history to 7th and 8th graders. And a week before I started my second year, I went and spent a day at a Franciscan friary in southern Vermont. And front and center on display in their bookstore was something called A People's History of the United States that I'd never heard of. Mm-hmm. So I grabbed it up, read it, and it became the basis for my teaching for the next few years. And it was a wonderful enrichment of all that I had learned before that. And it made a big difference in how I taught American history. And then 20 years later, 2 years ago in September 2001, at a family gathering, my brother Stephen, who worked at the World Trade Center, cornered me and said, Dara, I'm reading the most wonderful book, and I bet you've heard of it. And he went on to talk and talk and talk about this book. And he said that during downtimes on the trading floor up in Tower 2, when they would turn to really debates over places people had in this society, his group of traders, and my brother took his positions he was very concerned with exploitation and things like that. One of his coworkers said, I have a book you have to read, Stephen, and passed it on to him. And when he died a week later, he was halfway through it, and it was one of the main things on his mind.
But he was a trader on Wall Street, basically.
I know. And that's why I want Professor Zinn to know that these ideas were exciting and interrupting people's thinking in unexpected places.
Yeah, thank you.
Dara, thanks for your call. Howard Zinn.
Yeah, well, thank you. That's very moving that that your brother was reading it in that situation, and then he died. And what's interesting to me is that in the wake of 9/11, not everybody in the country immediately rallied to the idea that, we've got to seek revenge by picking out a country in the world and bombing it. Many of the families of people who had died in the Twin Towers got together, and they're a group which is now called Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. And their loved ones died in the Twin Towers, and they have opposed the wars in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq because they believe that that is not the proper way to deal with what happened in 9/11.
But opinion polls did show awfully strong support for the war on Afghanistan and later even for the war in Iraq. How do you interpret that, Howard Zinn?
Every time the nation goes to war, there's an immediate drumbeat of patriotism, nationalism. The flags are out. The president and the secretary of state are on television. The newspapers go along. The editorials go along. And an atmosphere is created in which, yes, then you get 70% of the people supporting the war, even though just before the war, half of the population was opposed to the war. And then a year or two after the 70% has gone down to 50% as soon as people learn more. That's the way that things are happening now.
But is it ever thus? I mean, how do you break out of that cycle? We're in war again right now.
Well, how did we break out of it in Vietnam?
Well, it took many years an awful lot of lives.
Yes, that's right. But it happened. The point is that at the beginning of the Vietnam War, two-thirds of the American people immediately supported the war. And a few years later, two-thirds of the American people opposed the war. What happened in the meantime is that people learned what was really happening in Vietnam. Today, the learning is taking place more rapidly. People are learning more quickly what is going on.
Jason's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Professor Zinn, I just wanted to tell you about how your book really helped change my my perceptions of the world and ultimately my career path, because I started out as a very conservative young Republican, and then and your book was actually the first non-mainstream account of history that I had ever read, and it was the first time I'd ever learned about organized labor and the labor movement, and coming from a working class household, it kind of made me wonder how in the world my family could be so conservative, especially around social things. And ultimately, I've now ended up working for organized labor and trying to bring about social change. So I wanted to say thank you.
There's a career change chalked up to Howard Zinn.
I'm happy to hear that. And, I must have, I get a lot of mail, and run into a lot of people, and I hear stories like that all the time. And what that says to me is that people can change. What that says to me is people can rethink the positions that they were given, when they were young, or the positions that were handed down by their family or by the newspapers.
So they can rethink, they can even change careers.
Yes, yes.
Let's get another call. Evan's calling from Andover, Massachusetts. Hi, Evan. You're on the air.
I've met Howard Zinn a couple times, and I read his book when I was 13, a freshman in high school. And I think that what is really important about him and what made me turn into an activist and a political songwriter after I first read his book is that he begs us to question the answers that are given to us by the state and by our history textbooks that we read in school and by the New York Times and NPR even every day. And I think that that's so important, and that's why, I mean, people call it a radical history, but I think it's really a radical truth-telling, and to tell the truth in a society where the truth is suppressed is a radical deed. And I think the questions that Howard Zinn asks us to answer are not so much, is war good, is war bad, but why does war happen? What is behind this? And I think that he really helped me come to terms with my political views by making me ask that question and making me realize, wow, it's not just that war is bad, it's that there is this thing that causes war. There is this economy that is based on profit over people.
Evan, how old are you, if I may ask?
I'm 18.
18. So when Howard Zinn writes, he says, let us imagine what radical change would require of us all. The society's levers of powers would have to be taken away from those whose drives have led to the present state. That is, taken away from the giant corporations, the military, and their political collaborators. We would need, by coordinated effort, to reconstruct the economy, producing in a cooperative way, working a few hours a day, free housing, health care, food, education, transportation for everybody. Is that the vision that inspires you? Is that a vision that's going to unfold in the United States?
Well, I think that there's two things at play here. One is, I remember earlier in the program, I kind of jumped out of my seat when you jumped on Howard talking about communism as it being the opposite of capitalism. I think it's very important that we not talk about it like that, because
I'm not mentioning communism here, just Howard Zinn's vision.
But I'm saying that there are lots of things that are in opposition to capitalism. There is anarchism, there is postmodernism, etc. And I think that, yes, I do have a vision of a world where people are free to live their lives the way that they want to live their lives, and people are not forced to be separated from the means of production. And I think that we do have to take that power away from the ruling class and from those who benefit from the fruits of the labor of the working class. And I think that the way we take that power away is by simply working together and building our communities. I don't think Howard or myself necessarily would say that we should all be amassing arms to overthrow the government. I think that it's a slower process than that of building our communities, and the more things that we learn to do ourselves and take care of by ourselves, the less we have to rely on the government and corporations to do them for us, and the less power that they have over us.
Evan, we got it, and thanks for your call. Jack Beattie, I wonder what you make of American politics in these years that this book has been on the market, ever gaining in its popularity and number of sales. Those have been the years of the Reagan Revolution, of George H.W. Bush and the first Gulf War, of Bill Clinton, the most centrist Democratic president in a long, long time, of George W. Bush. Not exactly Zen men.
No, but look at what we're finding out here. The people whose lives have changed, not just their views, their lives. I don't know of any other, Shelley said that poets were the unacknowledged legislators of mankind. Well, there's a lot of that going on here, it seems to me, down below. I mean, a million readers, some of them affected like this. It doesn't register yet, and may never register in full way in politics. But just as someone who writes himself, I'm just so impressed to hear people again and again who just have these stories about how...
The impact it's made.
Yeah,
it's amazing to see ideas churning through people's
That's
lives.
It. Yeah.
Sonia's calling from New Bedford, Massachusetts. Hi, Sonia. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm excited to ask my question. I'm wondering what is the view of what the fundamental basics are, like in America? Like, is it two cars? Is it a house? Is it an apartment?
When you say fundamental basics, what do you mean, Sonia? That people need, would have, would aspire to what?
Right, what the vision is of fundamental needs being met, what that looks like, what are those needs? Like, how does transportation look? Is that two cars for the house? Is that what is the basics of that need?
That's a pretty interesting question, Sonia, and thanks for your call. Howard Zinn, how about that? Because, of course, we saw what fundamental basics emerged as in the Soviet Union, in communist China. They weren't too great.
No. I don't think we should confuse... What happened in the Soviet Union, what happened in communist China, with a vision of a cooperative, even socialist society. It's those countries were not socialist societies. There was a socialism in this country represented by Eugene Debs, by Helen Keller, by Emma Goldman, by Jack London, by Upton Sinclair. There was a socialism in which the vision was not of a dictatorship or a bureaucracy, certainly not of a militaristic state, but the vision was that the wealth of the country should be used for human needs.
But the people who pushed these ideas in the Soviet Union and China were not all monsters either. They were very well-meaning. There were true socialists there who wanted a wonderful utopia for their people.
There were people like that, but in fact, those people did not gain the power in the Soviet Union. The people who gained the power were the small group of people in the Politburo, and ultimately one man, you see, who gained the power. And what they did was to destroy the vision that so many people had initially at the beginning of the revolution.
With just a minute left, I don't want to miss Sonia's question. How would you see the fundamentals, the basics that would be in the Howard Zinn America? Would it be an affluent society, or is it something more simple?
Well, not affluent in the sense of having three houses and two yachts and a private jet. but people, I see a society, and we have the wealth to do it. That's the important thing to understand that. We have the wealth to do it. I see a society in which people have health care which is free. In other words, the same health care that people in Congress have, which is free and paid for out of the national treasury. Nobody should have to go through insurance companies. Nobody should have to fill out forms. Nobody should have to have their health care determined by how much money they have. Health care, their education of their kids taken care of, housing available to everybody.
Ladies and gentlemen, yes. We're out of time, but there's the dream, the Howard Zinn dream, and people keep reading it. Howard Zinn, thank you so much for coming in tonight.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.